All right, morning. Thank you for trekking all the way over to the AT&T Conference Center, which is very far from the Austin Convention Center. Should get a procedural matter out of the way. The hashtag is listed in the little guide as SXNet_power. There is no underscore in that, so it is hashtag SXNetPower, all one word, no underscore. So, bios are...
There's a guy that says it's just net power.
Oh, and then there's a guy that says it's net...
Awesome.
What do you like?
If we can own net power permanently... So, they're talking to people in the room anyway. I'd much prefer for this to be a discussion. I've heard many complaints from people at the conference that people just kind of talk at a room full of people, which is fine when you're hungover anyway. That's how I went through college. I just want to start with a quick observation from last night, and then I'll roll it over to my co-panelists. I didn't want to talk about this, but then something happened last night, so I have to. We've all seen... Our latest net power phenom is the Kony 2012 campaign, so we have to talk about it, right? And I wasn't going to talk about this, but I was walking down 6th Street last night on the way back to my hotel with my wife, and she saw the Kony 2012 poster, which has Kony, and then in his shadow stand Bin Laden and Hitler. And at the bottom there's a statement that says Kony is worst. And I thought that was a little much, but my wife thought it was really a little much because she's a Jewish activist and an attorney, and now she has precise body count on what kind of damage Hitler did. We saw the flyer, and she said, "I'm going to pull this down." And she pulled it down. She thought about it, and she realized she was engaging in an act of perhaps censorship. And she pulled it down. And we continued up 6th Street, catching up with these flyers, and she pulled three more of them down. And I hope I'm not incriminating her in Travis County. But anyway, to continue. And eventually we came upon the posterers, who were four teenagers, probably from the Austin area, who were hanging up these flyers. And I said to me, "I think I should talk to them." I said, "Well, why not? You know, you're an expert. Why don't you talk to them?" And... she asked them if they thought, you know, they're conflating Kony to, you know, mass murderers of the 20th and 21st century was a good idea. And they said, "Well, yeah, at the moment, this is the worst person on planet Earth." "Well, how do you get to that?" "Well, he is. He's just the worst. He's the number one on the international court's, you know, hit list to get." "Okay, well, that's interesting. But do you think he's really the worst of all time?" And the whole debate, and it just, you know, ran around, you know, body count and, you know, who gets to be, you know, top on the list, you know, for all time versus now. But it was very interesting to see how these people were mobilized to get posters out, and they were emphatically willing to defend the content that they were distributing. But they didn't seem to entirely grasp the gravity of what they were saying by their postering action. And they stopped hanging up the posters after my wife glared at them as they tried to hang up another one. So she effectively censored them on 6th Street for a couple hours, or maybe not that long. But we have the hype cycle has come to politics. And I guess that's what this panel is about. Is the internet matters for power politics internationally, nationally. We're in an intermestic world. So I'd like to kick off to my co-panelists who'd like to pick up on Kony, and we will walk through. I hope we will, just for sake, things that I think would be interesting to talk about are everything from the FC Arab Spring to you know, as kind of a mass mobilization social power movement enabled by digital technology, to Stuxnet, a power politics act undertaken probably by states in a clandestine fashion as our boundaries of net power for today. So if anyone would like to hop in, Mary, you look ready.
Sure. So I'm going to focus my attention on proposing that we destroy the word slacktivism. and that we make it no longer valid, so people can no longer use an argument. So I'm going to propose why we shouldn't be able to use the word selectivism. So Zeynep Tufekci, who is at TechSoc, has a very nice blog post up. And I've written similar things, which is to say that it's a portmanteau of slacker and activist, which is the implication that someone is an activist but is doing it in a slacking and lazy way, to which she and I both say, show me one politically active person for which the addition of a technology has made them less politically active, right? So what she points out is that the internet and user-generated content has allowed previously apolitical people to take some kind of action in terms of, you know, symbolic power, shaping public opinion, self-identifying about caring about a cause, however you want to think about it, that puts them at that level of political engagement, public political engagement. So it's not that technology is making politically active people less active, because that doesn't make any sense. I can't think of any empirical evidence that would support it. It's allowing previously apolitical people to take that first public step to being politically engaged and connected to a cause. The second thing is that just because X doesn't cause Y doesn't mean that X and Y are unconnected. So if you say, okay, back in 2006 in Egypt, there's an active blogosphere, and they're talking about politics. It's like, oh, well, they're just sitting behind their, you know, their desk, they're at home, they're not in the streets, what are they doing? You know, and then you fast forward a few years, you have the Arab Spring, right? The blogging did not cause the Arab Spring, right? But the blogging created an open space that allowed politically active or politically interested young people to engage in a safer way than they could offline, and it snowballed. So we have to think more complexly. We have to think about extended streams of causation. You know, we used to, everyone knows the example of the butterfly flapping its wings that causes a tornado halfway across the world. And the thing is that now, with digital footprints, we can actually see how that connection might happen, right? We can see how, you know, people criticizing Putin in blogs 2 years ago is connected to what's happening now with people getting out in the streets and The Economist having a front page story that's saying the beginning of the end of Putin. So slacktivism, it's making previously apolitical people political in a way that they were unable to do before. It's the beginning of a ladder of engagement that doesn't lead directly to the change that's sought, but is an extremely important part of that process. So there's no such thing as slacktivism, because slacktivism means that what the people are doing doesn't matter, and it does.
Well, okay, so there's an assertion there that information technology or the social web is going to make the apolitical more political.
Then. No.
Okay.
No. Allows people that have some political interest to express themselves in a way that they couldn't before, and it's like...
It lowers the barrier to entry for political speech?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to let Richard jump in on this.
Okay, I mean, I'm going to do probably the thing that is most kind of unexpected from somebody coming from State Department. You expect policy or, you know, deep dive into issues that deal with foreign policy. But what I'm actually going to do is look kind of pull back the curtain a little in a large organization. And first of all, I just want to see from you, how many of you have worked for a company or organization of more than 500 employees in the last 4 years? Good. Okay. What I'm going to say is the power of the internet is that the experience that we have as consumers on the web, as activists on the web, is really powerful. Yet when we go behind the firewall in our large organizations, we feel so lame. And just like Starbucks, whether you like Starbucks or not, made it impossible to serve crappy coffee in America now, I think the web is going to make it be essential to have in an organization the ability to do all the kind of social activities you can do externally, internally. And that's going to transform how we do government, how we do foreign policy, how we communicate. I mean, there's a famous quote by Lou Platt, who was once the, he's passed away now, but he was the CEO of Hewlett Packard. And he once said, if HP only knew what HP knows, we'd be three times more profitable. What I like to say is if the State Department only knew what the State Department knows, we'd be closer to world peace. And all of that happens behind the firewall. So if we're doing it with kludgy, crappy, out-of-date software, if everybody is using email for everything, if it's the one hammer they have to communicate with, we're not going to be very effective. So what's going to happen is all this social, and frankly, you know, as we move forward, and we're even seeing this even in a recession, where Fortune 50 companies are losing people in well-paying jobs because they feel that the tools they have to work create a hostile work environment because they can't connect to Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and Tumblr and a lot of other things at the workplace. So that's a small thing, but it's, I think it's really important. And since if you've worked in a large organization, you've had that experience, but it affects all of government and our ability to engage with the public and on issues that the public care about.
Just, I guess, on the Coney issue, and I'd maybe after this love to hear, since it's a small enough group, to get some ideas from you folks and how you're thinking about the whole campaign. I would say that, you know, if I'm wearing my humanitarian hat, you know, there are countless of videos that have been produced in the past that have not had the kind of attention that this video did get on Coney or other issues in Africa or Asia and so on. So obviously there's something that they did that was right. And also, if you look at the sort of communication theory and look at Katz and Lazarsfeld, you know, political change does not just come from broadcasting information alone. It's a two-step process, right? There's the broadcasting information, and the second step is where there's this discussion, a social discussion around the content that was broadcasted, and between friends, family, what have you, and that's where political opinions and political change sort of happens. So, and that's clearly what they've been able to do. It's a problematic video, but in a way, that's its success. People are criticizing it, I guess, in a way because people are also a little more informed, and so there's engagement, there's pushback. You know, they're not just letting this video go by, you know, unscathed, if you'd like. So, in that sense, I think it's quite successful. But of course, there, you know, like I think many of us, I do have mixed feelings. But what can we learn from this, right? Mm-hmm. From the actual campaign, why was it successful? And I'm sure there are a lot of hypotheses right now, but you know, we need maybe a deeper analysis later on. But just out of curiosity, anybody have? Can I?
Yeah.
Since we wanted to make this interactive, thoughts on the Coney Net Power?
Yeah.
I find the Coney video kind of an interesting phenomenon because they jumped on a particular convergence of events, the election, and the phrasing and the marketing was really well done. And while I tend to sympathize with the people who are taking a critical step back and looking at it, a lot of that outcry from the other side, the side over there, is coming off a bit like jealousy.
Player haters.
People paid attention to Syria, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I love the Zucker Fecker in a bit. That really comes off for any cause to say things like that.
Maybe we could also just self-identify when we speak, so
yeah,
that.
So we know.
No, it's just interesting to know.
Yeah. Yeah. Who are you? Yeah.
My name is Carolyn Anholt. I've been working on a USAID project to promote information security in the development.
Cool.
Oh, cool.
Nice.
I have to talk to you about something. Yeah.
Yeah. Andy Carvin, NPR. Just to continue with what you were saying, I think the trouble that I saw a lot of people discussing with Coney wasn't the blanket talking about my pet cause. It was more focused on the naivete of the policy interpretations of the video, and some things they claimed as fact that, you know, were not true. And I've seen a number of articles written by people who actually are experts in the region saying they're possibly undermining the very cause they're fighting for by making it so simplistic.
And I think
that
part, I
can say,
I tend to agree with the
reaction
to it.
Honestly,
for a
30-minute
video, I'm
impressed
that anybody sat through it.
Yeah, I know.
Right? That's
I
the
know.
First.
Yeah, that in itself
was, I think, easy to learn. You know, I don't even know who it was and everything, and I started watching anyway.
Yeah. Was there a comment in the back?
Yeah. I'm Shauna DeLogo. I'm a researcher and I'm giving a talk here tomorrow in this room about Mexico's drug traffickers and how they use social media.
Oh, neat.
So, nice.
I see this all the time in Mexico, and I literally see it. I work with policymakers there, and no one seems to care that Mexico is disintegrating under our feet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Falling apart.
Yes.
The number of videos that are facing millions of hits, like tens of millions of dudes getting their heads off and cut off with chainsaws. Mm. That's the thing that's ubiquitous in Mexico. I don't understand how something like this can take off in Americans or understanding in Mexico. Framework here, but what's happening in Mexico is completely from like the average citizen up to like federal policy.
I actually have an idea of why. I'm going to actually argue that it didn't matter what the video was about. It mattered how they framed it. I would argue that they could have dropped basically any cause into the framework that they created, and the visual style they created, and the narrative structure they created, and it would have worked in a similar way. What is that? Well, if you think about what is the beginning of the video about, it's about how great social media is. What were they using as their platform for dissemination? Social media. What was the one thing they knew about their audience? These people like social media, right? And that's just one example. It's a video for white people. The protagonists are white people. It's cynical, but I think that was part of what made it work. And it follows a simplified narrative structure. There's an antagonist. There's a protagonist. It follows the tropes of American popular culture. It's a similar visual style that you might see on MTV. Right, motion graphics and a rock soundtrack. So as someone who is mostly involved in research but also interested obviously in practice, it's okay, so that's why it worked. Should others replicate it? You know? And I think that's a real serious argument, because obviously I'm saying, hey, it stars white people. If you want to talk to white people, put white people in it. And so there's one thing that's saying, hey, people are not talking about Coney because they did this kind of cynical thing. Another thing is, yeah, but if I'm talking about Mexico, do I want to have a video starring a guy from California with a surfer accent?
I would add that successful advocacy often is about telling a simple story, right? So that's almost a formula. You simplify, you have the antagonist, protagonist, you have the narrative, there's a plot, you can follow it, you know the conclusion, and so on. And so that's why I think it has a lot to do with why it's successful. It's simple. It's a 30-minute time, maybe. But I would also add that, so simple stories then lend themselves to simplified issues, simple solutions, and then, of course, those simple solutions, if implemented, can ultimately do more harm because they've simplified a complex situation to the point that you're actually going to have negative consequences. But then can you tell a complex story and have that advocacy be successful? Or do you want to ask me?
Well, you actually hit on, I was going to ask the question of, is stripping out context counterproductive? We now are trying to master kind of an international politics of memes. And not that there weren't memes before, but this is forever the critique. And maybe Richard, you carry further on this than me. That the diplomats are always much too convoluted in their understanding of the issue. So, explain how that works in the foreign policy process, where complicated does not equal decision.
Well, I mean, this is a very old example, but it's one I think, for a variety of reasons, trying to be nuanced means you lose. And again, regardless of which side you play out on this, the idea of genetically modified food in Europe, we tried to have this very nuanced scientific-based approach, and how much room were people going to reserve in their mind for genetically modified food? Not much. So if you're trying to be complex science-based, to dig down deep, none of it's going to stick. Mm-hmm. And then an activist stands up and calls it Frankenfood, That's sticky, memorable, really imaginative, and that fills that space. And there are a lot of other things that happened, a lot of missed moves in our efforts, and there's like the political side that, you know, U.S. is the leader in green biotech, Europe's the leader in red biotech, and so, you know, there's a whole economic wave behind it as well. But from the pure average person, trying to explain, you know, from a scientific standpoint, not going to win, having a great handle does. And did.
Should we put it out to
her? Yeah, go ahead.
Any other comment? Oh, the young lady in the back. Did you raise your hand, say no? Okay.
Yeah. And if you could identify yourself.
Someone using the microphone.
Sorry, I missed the beginning. Long and convoluted bus ride. But we're talking a lot about the Coney stuff, obviously, and we're all thinking about what worked and what did not work. And part of what has struck me is after I wrote a post about talking about how it might be a defining moment by lots of teenage age kids, because I don't have the data for this. But my sense of how this came to me and how I saw the spread was mostly high schoolers. And they're
I harangued 15-year-olds with my wife last night over this. So I mean.
Right, and I'm now flooded by people kind of emailing me saying, yeah, I heard this from my kid, and my kid. And I'm really thinking, like, a lot of the advocacy people had this reaction that, you know, it's got this white savior complex, the message is misleading, the thing is out of date. I mean, I can, and I think that's a very valuable conversation. And a lot of teenagers now are being exposed to this. Right? They're hearing the complexity. But I think this is going to be a possibly one of the defining moments for some number of them. I can't really tell you what number of them this is going to do, but you always, when you find lifelong activists and you say, how did you start? There's always this complicated story on, well, I started collecting money for this and it turned out that, and then there's this sort of gateway moment, gateway calls for them, and usually the first cause is they're not what they stay with. And I was thinking, you know, when I see this happening, my thought was, what can people interested in promoting social change do to step into this gap where you have this large number of teenagers who are excited, moved by the idea that it is a world in which they want to engage and condemn something that is obviously condemnable and horrible. Right? I mean, the impulse is a good one. Right? It's much better than, I don't know, changing the brand of your clothing, to, even if it's a small thing. But I haven't really seen that kind of, how do we engage this audience response from anyone yet. I see a lot of effort to criticizing this thing, and I'm all for that. I don't know if I was just curious if you guys are aware of, like, if I were an advocacy group in this field, I would be thinking, okay, how soon can we get our YouTube video up? How can we pull an all-nighter and put something together, anything? I haven't seen it, and I was wondering if I'm not seeing it because it's so big, and why?
Well, I mean, the upload statistics for YouTube videos, I mean, basically no human being could ever hope to watch even a fraction of what's being uploaded to YouTube every day. And it's the wheat from the chaff problem.
I mean, since you have a viral thing, right, and you have to measure the impact of viral things, you kind of have to think of them logarithmically, because once they're 40 million, it's easier to get to 45 million. But that means their fallout is also very large. So you could potentially get, say, your response be viewed by a zillion people, like a much larger number than...
Do you have the data on that?
A zillion was the
term
I
thought.
By the way, Zeynep wrote a must-read blog post on this.
That's the one that I mentioned about symbolic power, so technosociology.org.
And one other point that you made in that blog post was also there's a signaling effect amongst teenagers as well. You're signaling that this is something that you're watching or that you've just become knowledgeable about. And so I think that on its own as well, especially if you have social networks, can also help, you know, within teenage sort of circles as well, can help spread and create all kinds of other ties perhaps as well. So, but it's a good point. You know, people become activists for different reasons, and this could very well be one of those defining moments for a young activist who maybe is in their teens but are not really out in the streets doing the sort of the hardcore, perhaps, you know, occupied Wall Street, but is spending a lot of time on Facebook, and maybe that's their entrance to the space as well. So that'll be really interesting to see, actually, maybe over the years, if we can look at that and assess that impact.
I'm just going to respond to Zainab's question about engagement and asking how traditional organizations like nonprofits are going to engage the network. I don't think it's going to work that way anymore. I think it's going to be peer-to-peer. I think the network is going to engage itself, so to speak. I think that NGOs, traditional centralized hierarchical organizations that, quote-unquote, engage the network, are going to be doing it as a peer, engaging the network on its own terms, like this video did, you know, saying, like, you are... Anyway, so, yeah, I don't think the traditional nonprofits are going to capitalize on the power that we've seen expressed through this Kony 2012 case.
Before the question, the one thing I want to get out that I think, so for anyone who's, you know, middle-aged like me, it's interesting the shift. So how were, when I was a teenager, and I had to describe, you know, a couple of years ago how I got interested in politics and international policy. And I had to describe one of the defining moments as when Sir Bob Geldof, you know, alerted us all to the plight of Africa, which I knew nothing about. It's the only kids I knew from Africa were diplomat kids. Whose dads worked at the UN, and they seemed perfectly nice and spoke English better than I did. But, you know, clearly activism knew the medium for 1985, which was MTV. If you wanted to alert white households in the United States in the mid-1980s, you got on MTV and you grabbed them. And that mobilized a lot of effort. Did it change Ethiopia over the long haul? Deeply impacted me. So I do think that you know, this does represent an interesting shift in how activism will be born in people who will become public-minded. So with that, let me stop blathering. And gentlemen in the back, if you could identify yourself.
My name is Nicola. I work for the New York Organization. We train our members. We teach a lot about, you know, trying to build sustainable. If you want to build a sustainable concept, I mean, the only thing I worry about this is it's going to end. I mean, it's already, you know, clear we'll drop it off with trending topics. We'll tweet about something else. I'm sure that already has. Isn't there a risk? I mean, the opportunity here to fundraise, how do you build a sustainable something like this? I mean, I'm trying to think of how you keep.
So, Richard, you have some interesting ideas on sustainability and entrepreneurship that ports over to social.
Yeah, so some of the things, and you know, so I've done a lot of work in this completely separate on promoting entrepreneurship as U.S. foreign policy, and how, you know, how do you take a country that has pieces of an entrepreneurial network and grow it so that the entire system produces more startups and more jobs. And it's really grassroots. I mean, it's very, you know, you can't do something sustainable with a light touch. You've got, you know, trust is really important, credible exposure. You have Luca's here from Italy. He can validate that we actually did move the needle in a couple of years. But I think that, you know, the real heavy lifting for something that's sustainable has to happen kind of offline, and that's the power of people connecting online and then being able to move offline. You know, for a long-term sustainable effort is pretty essential, I think. It's anyway, that is a different example in a different area, but that was our experience.
In terms of keeping it going, I would say, you know, strategically, what is the strategic requirement? Basically, you want to have supporters that can be mobilized if there is a decision point that can be made. If the opportunity structure changes such that, you know, the UN is voting on a resolution or the US is deciding some kind of, you know, intervention and you want to vote A or nay, you know, so just keeping the audience aware. I mean, to me, that would mean like continuing a conversation, you know, bringing together people in some kind of community, and just keeping people engaged in a conversation such that it's high enough on their radar that if you say, okay, I need you to call X person and I need you to tell your friends to do the same thing, that they'll do it. And that doesn't seem like such a crazy idea, especially if even if you get, you know, a tiny percentage of the people that share the video to become engaged in that way. You know, you would they would easily have thousands and thousands of people calling whoever this representative is. So that's the how I would see, and I feel like that's not such a crazy idea.
Good point. And if you look at, I mean, just an analogy, but you know, with Wikipedia, sort of 20% of users are responsible for 80% of the content. So do you need it to be sustainable at 80 or 100%?
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think so. I think what you have with these signaling effects again is. Some people who sort of self-identify with this particular cause and then maybe connect with a few others, and that continues that particular activism. It does not need to necessarily stay so public, so visible, 100% every day out.
And it can't.
And it can't, right? Yeah. And then there's fatigue, and news media is tired of the same story, mm-hmm. and they're going to change. Mm-hmm. And there are other issues around the world beyond just yours. right? So it's okay, I think, perhaps to change. And I would say, you know, then we also need to learn maybe a bit from civil resistance as well. That's sort of there are phases to all of this, mm-hmm. right? There's mm-hmm. a big splash, you know, mm-hmm. signaling and so on. Mm-hmm. And some of the next phases that come later are, well, what's your message? What are your clear demands? What are your actionable, mm-hmm. measurable mm-hmm. demands? And can you then start repeating those very clearly and see if people are actually making progress to those demands? Until you have that, I don't know how realistic some of the demands from this whole Kony initiative are. But anyway,
stop there. Yeah. I want to shift to a different issue. It's 11:30, so we can talk about mm-hmm. a different political issue. It's another intermestic one, but more domestic than international. I was chatting with a high school senior yesterday, and I explained to him what I do for a living, although I really still can't explain that to myself. And he said, so does this mean you know something about SOPA and PIPA? You can read my op-ed about it, blah, 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 that I was shamed into writing by Eric Davis from Google, that I was sitting on the fence, because I really didn't dive into the issue. But I wanted to make that shift and talk about, so Kony's, you know, to borrow Texas parlance, since we're in Texas, Kony is something where most activists... I don't have a dog in the hunt on Kony, other than I'm concerned about Uganda. I think what the LRA does is bad. But SOPA and PIPA, I've got a dog in the hunt on that one. I'm a consumer of digital product. I work at a university where we're having to spend money based on what laws come down regarding copyright policy. Mm-hmm. So if anyone would like to jump in with some thoughts about how they saw the activism work on SOPA and PIPA, other than stodgy old guys writing op-eds in obsolete news media, go.
Audience first.
Anyone have any? Is SOPA and PIPA so far off the agenda? It was so important back in December. It was huge.
There are two other panels or three other panels.
Yeah. Yeah.
So no one.
I mean, it's great. Obviously, they really mobilized so quickly, and that's why it's kind of funny the Kony thing. Oh no, they mobilized too quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Forgot about it.
Mm-hmm. So things don't last very long, even
important
things.
Bob, and then, yeah.
I attended all the SOPA people panels yesterday. One of the things that, you know, from our green room, but one of the things that came out of that was that, you know, it really caused the tech sector to have to take, stand up and take notice of the detailed way of what goes on in Washington. Mm-hmm. Before they were maybe interested in regulatory mm-hmm, issues mm-hmm. here and there, and you know, the relatively small presence, where now you know they realize that they have to pay more attention to the details of what goes on the Hill. Yeah.
I think that there's a difference between SOPA and Kony, because there was a lot of coordination.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
If you are a member of the, at least I know, Credo Action, PCCC, just about any of those lists, you got an email about SOPA. It's the website you can go to and take an action, and they take an email about it. Mm-hmm. And you will continue to get email addresses from this, to keep getting email about these issues. I went to the Kony website and didn't see a place where I could enter my email.
I don't remember seeing it. Like, I don't see many ways in the Arnvidia. There's nowhere I
And that begs the question. I mean, what the hell can any of us do about Kony?
They're not going to keep the message going. We can keep the message going about SOPA. We can organize.
Yeah, but I mean, you look at SOPA and PIPA, and what happened was, you know, you have people bombarding congressional offices. We live in a representative democracy. But how do we marshal, I mean, you know, to end the Kony problem, basically, you know, the implicit argument the Kony folks are making is if we send, you know, SEAL Team 6 out to, you know, the jungles of Uganda, the problem goes away. Mm. Yeah, the special ops are there.
The thing is, the U.S. has already responded to that problem.
So there always is going to be this difference in our actual efficacy.
One thing I will say about SOPA and PIPA is I think it challenged the idea that, as Richard says, that you need to go offline. That if you really, okay, you can mobilize people, they can be blogging, they can be tweeting to their friends, but eventually you have to do something offline. And I saw SOPA and PIPA, I think it's accurate, it really was online, you know. And even the actions of people blacking out their sites was online. And it demonstrated that it's about context. It's about who's your audience and who are you mobilizing. If the audience and the people you're mobilizing is online and you're going to get their attention online, it can work, you know. And I think that was another, you know, attack on the whole Slacktivism thing. So I thought that was another reason why the case was important. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And we also work on my parents, which is another big issue. I think one of the things I've seen, though, is that there was no real pro-SOPA sign. It was not doing anything in the individual space to combat it. Similarly, Common was not prepared to handle the crisis plan, so it was quite a great deal. Somebody mentioned Mexico before, and you know, Mexico has...
Right.
Yeah. Campaign's cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, and to me, I think that's part of it too, is that in Kony, obviously, the Ugandan government and everyone else involved, again, there's very little to basically be an anti-Kony message. So it's that organization versus disorganization that's actually.
There's a comment from the back or a question?
Yeah.
As opposed to Kony, which is trying to say, we don't like Kony and do this. And so, mobilization is really easy if you're trying to mobilize negative power or anti-power. It's pretty hard to then get the collection of people what to do next. So, playing defense is easy. Playing offense is hard.
So net power, the lesson is to be negative.
Yeah. The anti-power, saying, we don't like that.
Right.
Very effective.
But that doesn't necessarily.
What we want to replace that power structure with is much harder. It seems to fall apart, or have a much difficult, more threshold to cross over.
Because, you know, as Churchill said, you know, I'm paraphrasing, the work of a lifetime can be destroyed in a day. So negativity is easier to do.
Of course, that also forces you to be reactive.
Yeah.
Because.
Which
is not.
We don't like what they did.
Right.
We can mobilize and say we don't like what they did, but it's hard to mobilize and say what's the next step. Like, what's the next step? So, there is. It's wait until they mess up again and tell them no again.
Just thinking aloud, I'm just thinking also about game theory and first mover advantage versus second mover advantage. Maybe that's also one way to think about that, right? With SOPA, activists didn't necessarily take the first move. Something was trying to change, and the second move was the activists to say no. Whereas with the Coney exercise, it's like the invisible children are taking that first move, mm-hmm. and maybe that's mm-hmm. harder. And I like what you mm-hmm. said, and then they're asking something to be done mm-hmm. in addition to that. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
I guess we should try out some other topics.
Mm-hmm.
The one I want to throw out first is, so we have people from government and not government, and I wanted to point this at Patrick. So Patrick, the platform you work on, if the government found it to be quite useful. So could you tell us a little bit about how the government found your, the platform that you worked on in, up in Massachusetts to be useful? And I'm just curious what your interactions have been with you know, like Coast Guard, DHS, you know, DOD. What are your conversations like with them?
With government with respect to Ushahidi?
Yes.
Well, hi, Josh Nesbitt. So Josh was a colleague who got us this short code, 4636 number, SMS number, right after 24, 48 hours after the earthquake in Haiti that allowed us to crowdsource crisis information from the disaster-affected population in Haiti, basically getting their most urgent needs and their location that we then, very much in partnership with the diaspora, had that added to an Ushahidi map. What was interesting, I was actually going through the emails just a few weeks ago from January 2010, and in both cases, it was the U.S. Coast Guard and the U.S. Marine Corps getting in touch with us to basically leverage that information. The U.N. was nowhere near to be found. I mean, they also botched up their response, but that's not entirely their fault. It's complex and it's difficult in the system and all that stuff. But I think as Josh can, maybe I'll hand it off to Josh, who then you know collaborated directly with State Department at the time, Katie Stanton, to facilitate getting that short code, and then from Voila Comcel as well. I mean, what was your sort of relationship with... But what's interesting, I think, is that the majority applications of the Ushahidi platform has not been from governments. There are a handful, interestingly enough, in Dublin, municipal local government, Dublin, New Zealand, Afghanistan, and India. But otherwise, governments have not leveraged this. Quite on the contrary, if we're going to talk about net power, in the face of oppression and repression, governments have tried to shut the Ushahidi platform down, or at least that's what they started with. There was a learning dynamic here that was sort of my thesis for my dissertation, and it played out. In the Sudan, they blocked it. They blocked the website. That's easy, right? But if you block something, it's kind of noticeable. So you're inviting sort of a response in a way, a consequence. In Egypt, later on, when activists use a platform for the elections to do citizen-based election observation, the pro-Mubarak, the regime, pro-Mubarak supporters tried to basically flood the platform with pro-Mubarak reporting on how the elections were going, right? But they were so obviously pro-Mubarak that the activists were basically able to, you know, write them off and say, obviously, this is coming from... because they received 20 or 30 back-to-back reports that were highly pro-Mubarak. I imagine the regimes will learn a bit more and make it more nuanced and find ways to discredit the trustworthiness of data that's mapped on the Ushahidi platform. What we've seen in Russia, which is the most exciting, and I don't know if that's the right word, where a lot of dynamic learning and innovation as well as counter-innovation is happening between regime and activists. It's happening in I would say, almost like real time, and I've never seen it happen so quickly. Mm. The regime or pro-Kremlin supporters are developing videos, YouTube videos, on how to game crowdsourcing platforms, how to sabotage crowdsourcing platforms, and basically distributing that information. Mm. But of course, then the activists, it's a cat and mouse game, sort of try and find something else to, you know, circumvent repression and so on. It goes back and forth. Anyway, so right now, in terms of positive uses of the Ushahidi platform by governments, haven't seen that. We are talking to, or the State Department has expressed interest in doing something in Syria, but I have my concerns on just the security aspect of all that. But mostly it's been regimes not wanting to see this technology basically be public or flourish because they potentially see it as a threat.
Yeah, I mean, just actually, Josh has been on a couple of our tech camps, and we actively go out and teach and in real time work with you know, NGOs oftentimes who don't have a lot of technical experience in advance, these analog NGOs, and bring them together with people, who like Josh, who have the experience using it, and then, you know, over the course of 2 days, they become active engagers, and they also have a relationship with people in the U.S., but also people on the ground in the country. We would really look for the technorati in the country who can then have this longer-term relationship. And so we're active promoters in the use of these platforms.
Can I call out something that was tweeted that I thought was pretty interesting? And then retweeted immediately, therefore making it interesting. So whoever made the comment on it gets better. So
can you read it?
Yeah, sure. So Brian said, I'd love to talk about it gets better for an example of a successful long-term social net power campaign.
It was a classic like tipping point moment. I mean, there's a huge kind of generational divide on looking at gay marriage and the whole kind of suite of issues that might be around it. It's you just look over time, it goes from being irrelevant to kids in high school to being still an issue to older folks. And I think it hit at this kind of perfect time where the demographic and the kind of population balance, and it could tip it in a way that made it really human and massive. So
I also think it's about the pace of information cascades in various media. So Kony, it's actually a single starting point to the cascade, which is the release of the video by the organization on a couple of platforms. And we're still seeing the cascade continuing on, and now it's actually on meme-based. There's memes, Kony memes, but that's just one point. Starting point. Whereas it gets better, every time there's a high-profile video created, it restarts the information cascade, right? And there were a few months there where, every few weeks, some celebrity or some politician or some sports team would make their video, and then that created another cascade. And you could actually design a campaign that would work in that way. So that's interesting observation.
Next week. So Ron Deibert was someone we asked to come down here, and he couldn't make it. But instead, I'm going up to his conference in Toronto. And what he's doing, I thought was interesting. And I'd love to hear ideas on this. So we've talked a lot about how social mobilization works here, and this is a massive conference. 20,000 people are signed up for Interactive. I've heard. I don't know if that's the accurate count. And that's about the same number of people that showed up for the RSA security conference last week. Yet, there aren't a lot of people. There's a huge conference as big as this one that just deals with, computer security stuff. I'm throwing around ideas, but kind of parallel points. One, how come we in the activist community don't talk more about the information security dimension? And so I've been working with a friend and colleague who's with the FBI, and he said, we always talk about soft power when we're talking about this kind of activism stuff. And he said, but there is a hard power line we can cross over into with regard to information attack. And he said, so we're really at shard or soft power, figure it out, I don't know. And so what I'm really curious about is where the kind of harder, we haven't talked about Anonymous once. Five of them got arrested this week. But how does their, I would characterize Anonymous as a technologically interesting group, not necessarily virtuosos, but by the same token, a politically naive group to a great degree. How does that fit into our whole argument of people who are going to try to hack their way to changing the system, quite literally, by breaching information, by getting things out, And I'd love to hear thoughts on that, if there are any at the table. No comment.
I actually do think they're interesting, not because of their techniques, which at least from the outside seem like they're basically doing the same thing again and again and again, but organizationally. I mean, if this is a new type of civil society organization, which is even loose network seems like an overly permanent way of describing it, that's incredibly interesting to me. The whole idea of kind of pop-up civil society, you know, which is, or you could call it wiki social civil society, the simplest thing that works for civil society. So what's your goal? Okay, we're trying to attack MasterCard. What's the simplest thing that works? A group of hackers who can coordinate for a period of 48 hours. You know? Fine. And the thing is, you know, people are asking, you know, but what would that mean? What would this new kind of civil society mean if you're talking about a democracy? Could this kind of civil society sustain a democracy? Maybe not. But then you have to ask again, okay, what's the simplest thing that works? Okay, if you want to sustain a democracy, you can't have just a very loose network of people with the same email address. You know, you need something a little more complex. But I think it's, as an edge case, it's so fascinating.
So anonymous basically as a form of modern civil disobedience?
Phenotype, whatever the term is, of a civil society organism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the government. It's not a corporation. It's not a political party. It's not a nonprofit. But it's civil society. It's something new.
You guys, have any of you read The Starfish and the Spider? Mm-hmm. Ori Brofman. So it's kind of the leaderless organizations, and even, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's, there's even, you know, I mean, he uses the comparison between the Inca and the, you know, the Apache, and the Inca could be taken down because mm-hmm. it had a head and the Apache mm-hmm. couldn't because it was like a starfish, and it, so. Mm-hmm.
Fully distributed. We've got about 10 minutes left, and I wanted to ask a question. I wanted to ask this, but I thought it was a good closer. And that is, do we think that this is a window that we're experiencing where there can be mass mobilization through the social web to achieve goals? And as a follow-on to that, look out a few years, and one of the questions that I've been asking people, will we have a more balkanized internet? Will it be divided up into little pieces of pie? So just some thoughts on, you know, are big political actors going to get savvy about squashing these things? Mm-hmm. Are we going to, you know, go back to some sort of status quo that it looks like before this? You know, just throw out some ideas. I'm just curious. A few years out, what's it look like? To the room?
Alex, what do you think? evil laugh.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that Bushipoli's comments about Balkanized internet are spot on. There's been a vision of global network networks for a long time, and now we're seeing the emergence of, country-specific internets.
So this is Jonathan Zittrain's end of the internet kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Thesis. Yeah.
Stab at that one. So in my day job is at Rice over in Houston, where I hang out with our computer science and electrical engineering department. And Rice has actually built the largest WiMAX ad hoc research network that it was a digital divide project built in 2003. And it covers a couple square kilometers now, several square kilometers. So it has size. And what's very interesting is the number of actors who've tried to kill it. So first the telcos came in, and they tried to kill it because they said, well, this is a Hispanic neighborhood. Rates of affluency in Hispanic neighborhoods are rising. They'll become good cable subscribers who will then transition to internet subscribers to watch football matches back home. And then it was the city who came in and tried to kill it by co-opting it. Now, that's very different. So look at where your bits come from. They come from your major ISPs now and a finite supply of spectrum. So I don't see any radio spectrum, a big block that's really available at the moment in the United States that isn't either going to produce revenue for the United States or is currently producing revenue for corporations that's been sold. So when you talk about, I think, a distributed alternate set of pipes, the radio spectrum piece, so how it will come down to how do you hack radio? And then on the backbone side, it is, if you've ever been into an ISP operations center, you see pretty clearly, they can just say, and here goes a denial of service attack, and bad day for them, and they really should have gotten a user agreement with us to know that they could just have that traffic ported off to some pot someplace where it just dies. So I'm not very optimistic about the physical layer on that one. Higher up the stack, who knows? So that's my opinion on it.
I'll take a stab at 5 years from now. So what I would say is how I would make that guess, which is who is innovating? Which side is innovating? And at this point, it seems like most people that are trying to repress or control what I call digital activism are using censorship of one kind or another. So that's censoring by content, by word, or censoring by server location, that means censoring a whole site, or censoring a medium, such as turning off the internet. And censorship is not an innovation, it is a counter-innovation. So I see...
That's his idea.
No, I'm uncomfortable with that. I'm comfortable promoting the ideas of the people sitting beside me.
All joint ideas.
Okay, maybe... anyway.
Yeah.
So he has presented a good way of evaluating who is fighting better on this. And so I become optimistic when I see counter-innovation on the repressive side and innovation on the freedom side. I get depressed when I see innovation on the repression side. And I think the real innovation and repression is surveillance and crowdsourcing repression. So that's like when the Iranian government posts pictures of activists and asks their own citizens to help them identify. That worries me. So who's innovating? Who's counter-innovating?
The 50 Cent Army problem in China, where, how do you determine who's basically on the take?
I would say just on that point, I would say the example of the regime in Iran using crowdsourcing is not necessarily counter-innovation.
That is innovation. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, right, okay.
It is innovation by a repressive regime, and that's what makes me sad.
Okay. It's 11:59.
Can I just make one thing? So I'm part of an organization called the Meta Activism Project, and we're doing a project called Social Definition of Digital Activism. And so for anyone who has some time after the session, I have sheets of paper, and I'd love to have you write down your own definition or thoughts on digital activism, and then I would take a picture of you, and we would put it up on the internet. So because I can hear there's a lot of good ideas, interesting folks in this room. So if you have some time.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks. Have a great lunch, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.